So let's cultivate our motivation. We all became Buddhists, and we all took whatever level of precepts we possess, the five lay precepts, or one of the different kinds of monastic precepts. We did all of this for a reason. And it's important that we're very clear on our reason for becoming Buddhist and becoming a follower of the Buddha. So it isn't to get fame or glory or become renowned in Buddhist circles. It's not to receive offerings or to feel like we're special or privileged in some way. It's not to exert power over others. But our motivation was all to always grounded on seeking liberation, seeking full awakening. So we have to constantly check our mind and make sure that remains our guiding motivation, and that we don't allow any of the eight worldly concerns to sneak in and sabotage our spiritual practice. So for that reason, we continuously throughout the day reflect on our motivation and with effort cultivate a motivation seeking especially full awakening based on compassion for each and every living being equally. And then renewing that motivation, cultivating it, building on it throughout the day. And so that's what we're doing now as our motivation for spending the evening together and reading His Holiness's text. So our motivation is quite important. We always have to come back to it. I spent the day mostly editing some of Venerable Wu Yan's talks. And the last one I did right before coming down here was a story about Master Hongyi, who was one of the Vinaya masters in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And he was living at Nambutu, the monastery, which was one of the great Vinaya monasteries in China for centuries. And they were doing construction at the monastery. They had to do it all year long. And so Venerable Hongyi, Master Hongyi, had his room. The room next to him was vacant when they had to continue construction during the winter. Then two carpenters moved in next door to him. So at that time, they didn't have flush toilets. They didn't have electric lights in Taiwan, or at least not on that mountain. And so in the middle of the night, you have the two workers, you have the master, and they had a bucket where they all went pee-pee. So the bucket got quite full during the middle of the night with all of them using it. And it was started to overflow and go, you know, on the, I guess, the walkway or, you know, wherever they had put the bucket. I don't know. Maybe in some corner somewhere. And then morning came and the workers went off to work and the bucket was still there, filled with all of its nectar and quite stinking up the place. So Master Hongyi took the bucket out and dumped it. He got a mop. He mopped up the mess because it had overflowed and they had all walked in it and spread it all over the place. So he cleaned it up, and then he brought some soil in to absorb any remaining fluid and to quell the stench. And that was it, you know. And then the workers came back in the evening, and they saw that the whole thing had been cleaned up. And one worker said to the other, "Oh, did you do this? Thank you very much." And the other worker said, "No, I didn't do it. You know, did you?" And they couldn't figure out how it had gotten cleaned up. And then they remembered that there was a monk living next door to them. And they realized that he had cleaned up all their pee-pee. And they felt very ashamed, you know, that had happened. And yet for Master Hongyi, it was no big deal. It was like, okay, this needs to be cleaned up. I clean it up. And so that not shows not only his humility, okay, in not thinking, you know, he was special and somebody else should clean the bucket, but it also showed that he, you know, didn't have a lot of this discrimination amongst phenomena. You know, this is good, this is bad, this is pure, this is impure. I like this, I don't like that. I'll go near this, I won't go anywhere near that. Okay? So since he had quelled a lot of that kind of superstition in his mind, to him, you know, cleaning up the bucket was, you know, just something you do and it's done. So, you know, when you hear that kind of story about a great master, it makes us reflect on our motivations for doing things and how when certain things need to be done, we pretend we don't see them or we see them and then we quickly leave before anybody can ask us to help. Or if somebody asks us to help, then we say we're busy or that we did it last time. Or that, you know, our little toe hurts and so there's no way we can help with it. We have some kind of excuse, you know. And so then sometimes we leave it so that somebody else has to clean up. And if the other person feels the same way as we do, then the mess stays there and nobody cleans it up. Okay, because we all feel that we are too good to do that kind of work. Yeah, I am too privileged, or I am too learned, or I am too special, or I am too senior, whatever it is, to do that. Yeah, but rather, we have enough energy to point out the faults of other people in the community. Yeah, we're not too, you know, to anything to avoid pointing out faults in others. We will readily do that. Yeah, with no hesitation and kind of take pleasure in it. But the mess that we help to contribute to, you know, the overflowing bucket, which included our own pee-pee, we won't go near. Yeah. So So it's just kind of interesting, you know. These kinds of things show us the difference between somebody who's a practitioner and somebody who has, what was that expression, a good mouth? A learned mouth, a learned mouth. So somebody with a learned mouth and somebody who's really a practitioner. Okay? And so it makes us really look inside and, you know, ask ourselves, what is our motivation? And, you know, are we really seeking enlightenment, or do we just seek enlightenment at the when we're comfortable by our mouth, but then when there's something we don't want to do, then we seek enlightenment, but somewhere else, you know, not doing what is in front of our nose. Okay, so it's just something to think about. I like these kind of stories, you know, that they, I'm definitely on the side of the carpenter, not on the side of the master. So there's some work to do. Okay. So I want to make sure I'm in the right place. It's marked here, page 57? Okay. Yeah, the intelligence, the ability. Okay, so this is the section that talks about working with afflictions. And it's in the chapter about mind and emotions, which is in the book, Approaching the Buddhist Path, which is volume one in the series of the Library of Wisdom and Compassion. Okay, so in this section, we've begun talking about how to work with different afflictions, how to deal with the mind and calm the mind. Okay, so we finished in the middle of this section last time, so we're starting in the middle. Okay, so intelligence, the ability to precisely discriminate or analyze the characteristics of an object, is another mental factor that can increase or decrease the force of an emotion. When corrupted, intelligence incorrectly understands how things exist and creates more problems for us. When used correctly, our human intelligence and analytical capacity help us to overcome our destructive emotions. This intelligence may be a thought, such as a clear understanding of the disadvantages of anger, or it may be it may directly perceive a deeper characteristics of things, such as their constantly changing nature. Okay? Some afflictions are corrupted intelligence, okay? So they're called intelligence. They aren't actually intelligent. They're rather stupid. But they're called intelligent because they involve an analytic process. But because that process is deeply flawed, the conclusion reached is wrong. Okay? So consider the two extreme philosophical views. Absolutism, or what is also known as grasping at persons and phenomena as truly existent. And nihilism, which is believing conventionally existent phenomena are non-existent. Okay? So we often hear about those two extremes, absolutism and nihilism. So simply saying to ourselves, when we notice one or the other, this is a wrong view, will not make either of these disappear. Nor are prayers and virtuous aspirations sufficient to vanquish them. We have to counteract them directly by developing the wisdom or intelligence, okay, prajna or sherab in Tibetan, the wisdom or intelligence that understands reality. Absolutism and nihilism arise through thought processes, so they need to be counteracted through correct reasoning that shatters our previous certainty. As our understanding deepens, our wisdom will become the direct non-conceptual perception of the nature of reality. Okay, so this relates to what we were going over in the debate class last night. So initially, if we have the view of absolutism or the view of nihilism, what kind of consciousness is that? It's a wrong consciousness. Okay, conceptual or non-conceptual? Conceptual. Okay, and so then to move out of it, we can't just say this is a wrong view. Okay, there are stages of getting ourselves to the right view, and just saying this is a wrong view doesn't get us there. So from a wrong view, where do we go to? Okay, the doubt that tends towards the wrong conclusion. Okay, so we had the wrong conclusion. We held on it firmly. Now it's beginning to loosen because we go to the doubt, but it's still the deluded doubt inclined towards the wrong conclusion. Then we go to? Equal doubt. Okay, so an equal doubt. That is like, well, maybe things aren't inherently existent, but maybe they are. And then you go to? Doubt inclined towards the right conclusion. Yeah, I think things lack inherent existence, but I'm not really sure. And then we go to? Correct assumption. Yeah, that makes sense that things aren't inherently existent. So it makes sense, but we haven't really grokked it, if you know what grok means, okay? Yeah, we haven't, it hasn't gone into our bones. Yeah. Then where do we go from correct assumption? Yeah, to inference. So, you know, the correct assumption can say the whole syllogism. You know, oh, all persons and phenomena are empty of inherent existence because they are dependent arising, or because they are not produced by self, other, both, or causelessly. When's breakfast? You know, our wise mouth again. Okay, so it's going to take us a while to get the inference. Then from inference, we get to a direct perception, okay, a yogic direct perception. Okay, and then does one moment of a yogic direct perception banish it forever all at once? No, we need to meditate repeatedly, you know, and drench our mind in the correct view. Yeah, so that it can actually overcome once and for all the ignorance grasping through existence, as well as the seeds of that ignorance. Okay, and then we attain liberation. Is that the end? No, what do we need to do after that? Yeah. To eliminate, huh?
The cognitive obscurations.
Yeah, so to eliminate the cognitive obscurations that obscure us from attaining omniscience. And what are those cognitive obscurations? The latencies of ignorance and the afflictions. And then the dualistic appearance that they cause. Okay. So, you know, it's set up in a sequence, and we have to follow that sequence. And knowing what the sequence is very helpful, because then we can go in the right direction, and we can kind of chart where we're going and if we're, you know, kind of getting there. And we won't get all elated if we have some unique experience for a moment in our meditation, thinking that we're near enlightenment. Okay, but we'll, you know, still have our feet on the ground. So it's helpful to be aware of the mental processes that lie behind emotions. We may have habitual ways of interpreting events that make them appear threatening or desirable when they are not. Okay, so our MO, our habitual lens through which we view things that we're often not aware of at all. Okay. And this makes things appear threatening or desirable when in fact they aren't. Okay. So an example of making things threatening is if our habitual thing is to feel like, oh, I'm weak and others are strong and they're not to be trusted. They might harm me. So if that is our usual view of things, then that's what we see around us. Yeah. So it might be something like that. Or maybe our usual view of things is, you know, here's all these people. They're really wonderful. I wonder what I can get out of them that will make me very happy. So this one isn't afraid of people. This one wants to get something out of them that will make us happy and, you know, maybe make them happy too. Okay, so we approach people that way, and then that's how we see them. You know, that's what they mean to us. Okay, so we have these different ways. I just gave those as examples, but we each have to check inside of ourselves and see, you know, what is our habitual way of viewing people or viewing situations? And, you know, if we find that our habitual way of viewing things is actually pretty mistaken and erroneous and causing problems, then we need to retrain our mind so that we see people and situations in a very different way. Okay. So if we have those false ways of interpreting events, we can consciously begin to change our interpretations and thus change the emotions that result from them. This is the theory behind the thought training teachings, such as those describing how to transform adversity into the path to awakening. And so that comes in the chapter a little bit ahead on the 8 verses of thought training. You know, and that's what we're trying to do with the 8 verses is train our mind in a different way of perceiving things. Yeah, because our habitual way of framing things now is wrong. And it makes us pretty miserable. And it gets us stirred up, and then we stir other people up. So we, you know, need to really habituate ourselves to a new way of seeing things. Okay? And so, you know, that can sometimes be, you know, for example, if we have this habit of being suspicious of other people, you know, we need to do some serious work on the kindness of others so that we can trust other living beings. Yeah. Because if we don't do that kind of work and begin to see the kindness of others, then we may say, oh, sentient beings are kind and they've been kind in the past, present, and future. And I'm in debt to them for all their kindness. But we're still looking at them with suspicion. Okay, so we need to look at this. For example, a colleague offers to help us with a project, and we think, why all of a sudden does he want to join in? Does he want some of the credit for himself? Or maybe he wants to slow my work down so that our boss will be upset with me. Okay? So this is not uncommon, is it? This is not uncommon, and I'm sure this happens in many workplaces. Okay. Yeah. In fact, have any of you ever had that kind of idea? All you innocent angels. Yeah. Who just have to endure other people's stuff. Oh, one angel who's honest. Yes.
I used to have the really bad habit of wanting to co-opt projects because I thought I was going to do it better than the other person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so if we can nose our way into something and get some credit, yeah, then let's do it, right? And if there's a project and we really don't feel so confident that we can do a good job, then let's get somebody else involved. And then if it doesn't turn out so well, then we go scot-free and the other person gets the blame. Yeah. I appreciate your honesty. Yeah. Because unless we can be honest about this, then there's no way we're going to change. Okay. So then, you know, we begin to see, oh, look how my mind works. You know, I'm always looking out to get the best deal for myself, you know, and to make sure I get the credit and somebody else gets the blame. And this is how I approach it, approach so many things in my life. Yeah, from the smallest tiny thing to some big thing, you know, we're always navigating with this kind of thing in mind. Okay. Although we are not trained psychologists, we may even attribute a mental disorder to somebody else. Okay? So, you know, there's somebody in our workplace, there's somebody else in the monastery that, you know, we don't get along with. So this guy is passive aggressive and he's manipulating me because he wants my job. So, you know, we're holding on to our job tenaciously because we want the credit and we want the advancement, you know. But that guy, you know, he's passive aggressive. He's manipulating me because he's trying to get me out and take it all away. Yeah. So, you know, all of us have become amateur psychologists nowadays, haven't we? We diagnose people right, left, and center. Do you agree, psychologists or not? Yes. I've even gone to her and said, I think this person is, what was it? Oh, bipolar. Yeah. But she agreed with me. It took a while. Yeah, I diagnosed first, and then I got the psychologist to agree with me. No, it wasn't bipolar. It was passive. It was
borderline.
It was borderline. That's right. Yeah. See, I'm not even a psychologist. I can, you know, diagnose anybody. And as soon as you diagnose somebody, then, of course, you know, you've got them pinned. Yeah. Because then there's something wrong with them. Okay, so in this kind of case, we are mind reading. Okay, projecting a motivation to someone's action with little evidence. But I had lots of evidence when I did it. Becoming suspicious and hostile, we respond with a snide remark, and a conflict takes off. Unfortunately, many misunderstandings and arguments among people, groups, and nations occur in this way. In addition to developing our human intelligence and learning to use our logical abilities correctly, We need to make our minds receptive so that the seeds of constructive emotions and attitudes can grow in it. We do this by engaging in spiritual practices that diminish and purify the seeds of harmful deeds in our mind stream. In addition, practices that accumulate merit, the seeds of constructive karma, increase the force of our wholesome tendencies. These practices include being generous, living ethically, and cultivating loving kindness. And these are also the practices when we talk about Nundro or some of the preliminary practices, things like doing prostrations, Vajrasattva mantra, making offering bowls, you know, offering water, doing Dorji Khadro fire puja, or meditating on Samaya Vajra, or making mandala offerings, doing guru yoga, generating bodhicitta. So all these kind of practices that we do repeatedly again and again and again, and often try and accumulate 100,000, which really means 111,111, these are done to purify the mind and to accumulate merit. And that's very important. You know, when I started Buddhism, I didn't understand that. You know, what's purification, accumulation of merit? And yet my teachers kept talking about it. And so, you know, I started doing those practices. And I found that they actually helped quite a bit. You know, it's like my mind became more receptive to the Dharma. My mind became a little bit calmer. Yeah. And, so then you can begin to see the reason why those practices are prescribed and the benefits that you derive from that. I think my teachers somehow, well, at least the first Nundro, what Rinpoche did is he asked me, he had a very small picture, like 8.5 by 11 size, of the 35 Buddhas. So you can imagine how small each of the 35 Buddhas were to fit on that paper. And it was like a photograph of a line drawing. And he asked me to paint them, including painting the halos around them. So I was supposed to paint on something that was like a shiny photograph surface, these tiny figures. Okay. So, so I was painting them. And then I started getting interested. Well, who are these Buddhas? You know, because I had to paint them all different colors and they each had different hand mudras and thinking and so on. And I said, who are they? What do they represent? What's this photograph all about? And so then, you know, when I heard the explanation, having, you know, done this work on them, I said, oh, I think I want to do that practice. Yeah. So you can see the skill that my teacher had in getting me interested in doing it. Because I'm sure if he would have just come and said, do this, like, what? Yeah. Yeah. Vajrasattva was another issue, because they were organizing a group Vajrasattva retreat, you know. So if a whole group is doing it, well, I don't want to be left out, okay? And especially when I heard from the people who had done it the year before, you know, how wonderful it was, I said, oh, I've got to do it too. Yeah, great motivation, huh? It had a good imprint on my, it had a very good, effect on my mind, you know. And before I started the retreat, I said, I'm doing this retreat and I don't care what happens, you know, kind of, I don't care if somebody dies, I don't care what's going on, I am doing this retreat and I am going to finish it. And so that was a very strong determination, and it was good because it carried me through and I finished it. Yeah. In spite of being in the middle of the monsoon weather where everything smells like mold and mildew, and in spite a scorpion falling from the ceiling and landing right next to me. Yeah. Interesting things happen when you purify. Okay. Learning how to consciously direct our thoughts in a more positive way is essential for counteracting afflictive mental states. Repeating, anger is awful, may it disappear. Compassion is so wonderful, I wish I had it, isn't sufficient to transform our minds. Praying, Buddha, please inspire me to be compassionate, or Buddha, please get rid of my afflictions, without our cultivating the causes, won't work either. To be free of our anger, we must contemplate the kindness of others and train our mind in forgiveness and in love by practicing the meditations that evoke these virtuous emotions. When thinking about the value of compassion and requesting inspiration to develop it are useful, the real work is to contemplate the benefits of compassion and then practice the series of meditations to generate it. In our daily lives, too, we must repeatedly bring compassion to mind when we interact with others so that it becomes habitual. Okay, so we do all sorts of prayers, you know, in our daily practice. And tomorrow we'll be doing the Lama Chopa, and we keep bugging the Buddhas. Buddha, please inspire me to have this. Please inspire me for this. Please inspire me, you know. Yeah. And so we're always bugging the Buddha, you know, to inspire us. But do we sit down and do the meditations to develop those qualities or to gain those understandings? Okay. So that's what His Holiness is really hitting at here, that it's nice to aspire and to recite the prayers, and that puts good seeds in our mind, but we actually have to do the work. Yeah. It's the same of, you know, like, oh, may that overflowing bucket of pee-pee be cleaned up and the area be immaculate. Yeah. Wonderful aspiration. And then we don't do anything. Okay. Compassion broadens the scope of our mind and makes it more accepting and inclusive of others. That's true, isn't it? Yeah. We just change our mind by cultivating compassion, and our whole way of relating to other people and to ourselves changes. Yeah, quite noticeably. Now, we're more accepting of ourselves and others. We're more inclusive of other people. Not so judgmental. Destructive emotions such as attachment and anger usually focus on one person or one class of people, whereas compassion can be extended to all living beings. The object of our compassion doesn't need to be someone we have met, because we already know that everybody wants to be free of suffering and seeks happiness. When our mind is unhappy, compassion and love uplift us. Okay, so His Holiness is doing his sales pitch for compassion here. Yeah, this is one of his foremost topics that he's constantly talking about again and again. Yeah. The best offering to make to all the Buddhas is to abandon harming others physically, verbally, and mentally. Unlike afflictive emotions, virtuous mental states do not have self-grasping ignorance as a support. So cultivating the wisdom that overcomes ignorance won't harm our virtuous emotions. If anything, it, It will eliminate obstacles to generating them. If we really care about ourselves, we'll generate an altruistic intention because it gives us encouragement, enthusiasm, resilience, and a good heart. So a wisely selfish person is altruistic. Okay. So we need to really think about this, okay? That how, when we have compassion and altruism, it makes us, inside of ourselves, we feel encouraged, we feel enthusiastic, we're resilient, we have a good heart. Those are all qualities we want to develop, okay? And so when we feel, you know, kind of down, or we feel confused and we want to feel these good qualities, you know, or these certain kind of attitudes on life, then what do we need to do? We need to meditate to cultivate compassion. To cultivate compassion, what do we need to think about? Kindness of others, the suffering that they experience. Okay, so that's it in short. You know, I mean, you can do all the bodhicitta motivations, but definitely those two. Okay, and then, you know, we come out of it feeling encouraged, enthusiastic, resilient, you know, and open-hearted towards others. And that's a much nicer feeling than feeling shut down and judgmental and, you know, like that. Habituating ourselves to constructive perspectives is one of the purposes of the gathas, or short phrases used in the mind training practice. For example, while cleaning the dishes or washing the car, we think, I am cleansing away my defilements and those of all other sentient beings. When going upstairs, we think, I will lead all sentient beings to awakening. And when going downstairs, I am willing to go to suffering abodes to benefit sentient beings. In this way, neutral everyday actions are transformed into the path to awakening. Okay? So these gathas that you memorized, all of them, during your Bhikshuni ordination, do you still have them memorized? Part of it, yeah. But if you, you know, learn these, or you learn the short thought training phrases, even you don't remember all of them, if you continually, you know, even when you're walking from here to there or doing chores or whatever, think about these things, then you're keeping your mind in virtue. And when your mind is in virtue, your mind's going to be happy. When we don't do that, then even we're vacuuming or we're walking, our mind can very easily be complaining. Yeah. Oh, I have to walk over to go Tommy and do the laundry and it's so cold out in the morning. You know, why do I have to do the laundry over there? And it's too cold. I want to do it later, but they all want it done now. You know? So you got to walk from here to there anyway. So you can either have your complaining mind running a tail and making yourself miserable, or you can think about one of these thought training things. You know, I'm carrying all the laundry and I'm going to wash the defilements off all these sentient beings. Yeah, how nice. Or, wow, I get to offer service to the Sangha. You know, when they talk about creating merit, offering service to the Sangha is one of the things that creates incredible amount of merit. And here I have the opportunity to do just that. Yeah. Then you're skipping and jumping all the way to the washing machine. Yeah. But that beats, you know, like trudging along, like, oh God, the laundry. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing depends on our thought, doesn't it? It totally totally depends on our mind, not on the external situation. Yeah, so our mind can make us miserable and our mind can make us joyful. And so it depends where we choose to direct our mind. Some afflictions are destructive emotions that are counteracted by generating opposing emotions. For example, to counteract anger and hatred, we meditate on love. Other afflictions are distorted attitudes and wrong views that are counteracted by seeing that the object they apprehend is false. For example, the ignorance that grasps true existence is counteracted by the wisdom realizing the emptiness of true existence. Okay? So, different ways to counteract different kinds of afflictions. Imagination may be useful as a skillful means to counteract harmful emotions. For example, as an antidote to lust, what do?
Meditate
on the foulness of the body. Yeah, you don't look at porn pictures then. Okay, that's not the antidote to lust. Okay, so for example, as an antidote to lust, the Abhidharma prescribes meditating on the universe being filled with bones. Remember I was telling you about that meditation? It's actually a lovely meditation when you do it. I mean, it really settles the mind down. It's explained in volume 3. Although the universe isn't actually brimming with bones, by having us contemplate the inside of the body, this technique works to eliminate obsession with sex. In cultivating loving kindness as an antidote to anger, we may imagine others being happy. And when cultivating compassion, we may reflect on their suffering and wish them to be free of it. Scientists have noticed that when we imagine a situation, the same area of the brain is activated as when we actually experience that situation. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. This supports the Buddhist view of the usefulness of imagination in developing wholesome and balanced mental states. Yeah. So if you can't imagine it, it's going to be very difficult to make it happen. Yeah. And so we have to begin imagining these things and then work our way into making them happen. Applying an antidote may initially make us feel deflated, but this is not detrimental. For example, when we are arrogant, making the mind more sober is beneficial, isn't it? Yeah. However, if we are depressed, deflating our mood is not useful. So we must evaluate our mental states, first determining if a destructive emotion is present or not, and if so, then choosing an appropriate antidote. In short, we learn to become doctors to our own mind, diagnosing our mental ailments, selecting the correct Dharma medicine, and then skillfully applying that medicine. So we need to learn, you know, what the afflictions are. We need to learn their antidotes. And then we need to be able to identify the afflictions and apply the antidotes. Okay. Working with afflictive emotions requires a two-pronged approach. Managing unwholesome emotions and stopping actions motivated by them are important components, but they don't resolve all problems. We also need to cultivate wholesome emotions. Okay, so it's opposing the things that get you into trouble and cultivating the constructive emotions that create goodness. Although we may not initially be able to call upon these positive emotions in the heat of the moment, gradually and diligently cultivating them in our meditation practice affects our temperament and influences our emotional patterns. Okay? So we can't just say, oh, this is my personality, or I'm like this, there's nothing I can do about it. We can do something about it. And how do we do that? We systematically develop these emotions and systematically apply the antidotes to other ones, to emotions and views. Okay? The more familiar we are with these beneficial emotions, the less susceptible we are to harmful emotions. Yeah, it's like developing an immune system. Yeah, we have to develop our emotional immune system. Developing constructive emotions is similar to both. Oh, it says that in the next sentence. Developing constructive emotions is similar to bolstering our immune system. Cultivating love strengthens our emotional immune system, our emotional immunity to anger. Developing compassion prevents cruelty. Joy opposes jealousy, and equanimity averts bias due to attachment, anger, and apathy. Yeah, so we see what's afflicting our mind, and then we apply the antidote. Reflecting on the benefits of having a particular wholesome emotion invigorates our efforts to develop it. For instance, if we contemplate the benefits of seeing sentient beings as lovable and imagine the good feeling that will derive from that, we will happily meditate on their kindness. This will cause feelings of gratitude and appreciation for others to arise naturally in our mind. To see the advantages of certain practices, we can ask ourselves, what is disrupting my inner contentment? Then we then see the negative emotions as the culprits and want to oppose them. With this determination, we will seek the methods to counteract those disturbing emotions and diligently practice these methods. Okay. So, reflections. This is your homework. Yeah, talk about it at breakfast, lunch, medicine meal. Yeah, until next Friday. And you know, that doesn't mean stop after that, but, you know, really try and think about this. So first thing, how can you differentiate a destructive emotion from a constructive one? So when you talk about it in terms of your own experience. How do you figure out when there's a destructive emotion going on in your mind or a constructive one? Then two, what are the benefits of subduing disturbing emotions and cultivating wholesome ones? Okay, so think about that. And there are many benefits, so not just one or two. And then three, review the methods to subdue each disturbing emotion and cultivate each wholesome one. Okay? So that's better than talking about the temperature of the oatmeal and if it's too hot or too cold or too cooked too well or not cooked enough. Okay. Okay, so the next section is cultivating love and compassion. To generate beneficial emotions such as loving kindness and compassion for all sentient beings, we must first have a correct understanding of those emotions. The love and compassion we cultivate in our spiritual practice should not be confused with the ordinary love and compassion we feel for our dear ones, which is usually grounded in self-referential considerations, such as, this person is my friend, my spouse, my child, my parent, and so on. Okay, so anybody relating to me, anybody who brings me happiness, then much easier to have love and compassion for them in an ordinary way. Okay, while such love may be very strong, it is tainted with attachment because it is partial towards those who please us and biased against those who displease us. Yeah, and this is the way worldly people are, aren't they? Yeah? These people are nice to me. These people are part of my family or my group. So they're better, and I will care about them. And those people aren't part of my group, and they harm me, and they do awful things. So, you know, I don't like them, and I'm not going to lift my little finger to help them. Yeah, and you'll hear people say it just exactly like that. They're kind of proud of it, you know. This guy's such a jerk. I won't lift my little finger, even if he's dying. And people say, have you heard people say stuff like that? I have. Yeah, and they say it with such pride of, you know, like, oh, you know. I'm superior to that guy. I'm not going to go out of my way for them. Yeah, and then some people, yeah, they really kind of congratulate themselves on the strength of their arrogance and their anger and their decision to just ignore somebody else. Okay. So, yeah, we have some stuff to clean up, don't we? As we have seen, once we are attached to someone, the stage is set to later be angry at them. Yeah? Attachment, total setup for anger. Why do we get angry at them later? Because they failed to meet our expectations. They failed to fulfill our needs. They don't do what we want. So the more attached we are to someone, then the angrier we get when they don't conform with our notions of what they should do or be. The love and compassion we seek to cultivate in Dharma practice is based on having an equal-hearted sense of concern for all beings simply because they exist. And they want happiness and not suffering, just as we do. Okay? So ordinary, quote, love and compassion is based on partiality, and it has a checklist. Yeah? And we may not be conscious of our checklist, but it's there. Yeah? You give me gifts, check. You say things I like, check. You take my side when somebody else criticizes me. Check. Yeah. I can turn to you and ask for help and you'll do it. Check. Yeah. So there's all these conditions. And if a person meets those, then we have love and compassion for them. Yeah. But if they meet them and then they stop meeting those conditions, you know, we have strings attached, and then, you know, they're taking the strings out of our hands, and we don't like that. We can't play them like puppets anymore. So what we're trying to do in Dharma practice is create a sense of love and compassion that doesn't have those strings, that doesn't have those conditions. And it's not easy because we are so well trained in having a series of conditions and expectations. And not only are we well trained in having them, but we feel that if we give them up, then other people will take advantage of us. And that's one thing that terrifies us. We do not want to be taken advantage of. So that always reminds me of the Catholic priest who works in the barrios in Los Angeles. What's his name?
Boyle.
Hmm?
Boyle.
Yeah. Yeah, Gregory Boyle, right? And, you know, some people said that to him. You know, you're helping all these gang members, you know. Don't they take advantage of you? And he said, I give my advantage away. Yeah. I thought, wow. You give your advantage away so that you're not always looking at people in terms of what they've done for me and what I've done for them, and is it fair? That's no longer your way of deciding whether to help or how much to help. Yeah. Instead, the criteria is this a sentient being, and do they need help? Yeah. There's not this, and I don't know, are you very discriminative in terms of what I've done for them, and are they reciprocating properly? Yeah, and I don't want to be taken advantage of. Yeah, you're always asking me for this and this and this and this, and yeah, I'm not going to let you take an advantage. So I'm not saying that we just do whatever anybody else wants. Yeah, and certainly Father Boyle didn't do that. You know, he had wisdom. He said yes to some things. He said no to other things. So similar to that, to us, similar to him, we can do that. But the thing is, the perspective he's looking from isn't a perspective of, are we equally compensating each other? The perspective is, what does somebody need, and does my acting benefit them in the long term? That's the perspective. And if it benefits them in the long term, great. If it doesn't benefit them in the long term, leave it. Yeah? So it might be that you have, you know, some kid who's just coming and asking again and again and again and again for something. And you say no, not because you've given them more than they've given you, but because you see that they need to learn to take care of themselves, or they need to learn how to accept the frustration of not getting whatever they want. Yeah, so you still say no. Yeah, you don't become a doormat, but it's a wisdom kind of assessment, not a biased one. So this takes a lot of slowing down and really being able to think about things, yeah? Whereas our usual thing of, you know, well, okay, what have they done for me? How many favors have they done for me? And how many favors have I done for them? And then I decide whether I'll say yes or no. How thankful are they for what I do? How unthankful are they for what I do? You know, all that kind of assessment, that isn't involved, you know, in a way such that it's self-referenced, you know. Okay. Even if we understand the meaning of genuine constructive emotions, we may doubt that it is possible to develop them. We must remember that the seeds of constructive emotions are naturally in our mind stream, and when cultivated, they will increase. Everything becomes easier with familiarity, and positive emotions are no exception, said Shanti Deva. So don't think that Shanti Deva lies, because he doesn't. Okay, when we have the confidence that it is possible to develop positive emotions, we make the effort to do so. At this point, we engage in the meditations to cultivate equanimity and to see others as kind that precede the actual cultivation of love and compassion. Meditation on equanimity helps us to go beyond the limitations of our judgmental attitude that classifies people as friends, enemies, and strangers, and elicits the emotions of attachment and animosity and apathy towards them. By seeing that everyone is just like us in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, equanimity sets the stage for cultivating love and compassion for all beings, no matter what they believe or how they treat us. Wouldn't it be nice to look at all living beings as worthy of kindness? Yeah, even living beings that you think are horrible, you know, to still be able to look at them as worthy of kindness. We then cultivate the sense that others are lovable, which is done by remembering their kindness to us. Here we reflect not just on the kindness of friends and family, but the kindness of all those who do their various jobs in society that enable us to have what we need. We also reflect on the kindness of those whose disruptive actions challenge us to develop forgiveness, patience, and fortitude. So for all the Sams in the world. And there's many of them, but not us. We aren't other people's Sams, are we? No. We'd never behave like they do. We now turn our attention to the expansive love. So he's giving a whole meditation here. Yeah, if you aren't noticing it, go back and write out the steps because he's giving a meditation. We now turn our attention to the expansive love we seek to develop in our spiritual practice. This love is the simple wish for others to have happiness and its causes. Visualizing a variety of people, extend this wish to them and imagine them having happiness and its causes. Having done this, cultivate compassion, wishing them to be free of suffering and its causes. Do this with a few individuals to begin with, and then generalize it to groups of people, and finally to all living beings. Some people find it easier to first generate compassion and imagine others being free of suffering, and then develop love and imagining them having happiness and its causes. So you can do it, those two in either order. Initially, the feelings of impartial love or compassion that arise in the depths of our hearts will last only a short while. At this level, they are still contrived in that we have to make effort to experience them. However, through habituation, the time will come as soon as we see even a small insect. Feelings of love and compassion for it will arise spontaneously and effortlessly. This new experience manifests as a result of having made an effort over a long period of time. Such mental transformation brings about an enduring change in our moods and emotions. I remember hearing a story about Lama Tisha when he was traveling in Tibet. And he would, referring to his donkey or his yak, maybe donkey when he was in India and yak once he got to Tibet, he would call them my mother. Yeah? So he was training his mind, even though he was riding on their back. You know, this is my mother. This is my mother. Yeah? And he began to really see everybody as kind to him, like his mother, and have that kind of affection for them, like he would to his mother. Scientists and Buddhists agree that habituation is necessary for long-lasting change in our thoughts, emotions, and behaviors to occur. When we practice something repeatedly, it becomes part of our temperament. Buddhists describe this as a process of habituating ourselves with new emotional responses. Scientists explain this as building up new neural pathways in the brain. When a certain pathway associated with an emotion is well lubricated, that emotion arises more easily. So it doesn't really matter which way you see it. The important thing is to do it. Although Buddhism emphasizes cultivating love and compassion for others, we must not neglect ourselves. The happiness of others is one of our goals, so we must take care of ourselves so that we have the physical energy and mental clarity to benefit them. If we ignore our own welfare, not only will we be able unable to benefit others, but they will have to take care of us. Okay, so this isn't, advocating for this self-abnegating self thing of, I am terrible, I am unworthy of pleasure. In order to be compassionate, I have to suffer and completely ignore myself. That's not the Buddhist perspective at all. Yeah, we need to take care of ourselves. We need to be practical. We need to keep our life in order. We need to keep ourselves healthy. We need to pay our bills. We need to do all these things, because if we don't do that, then, we're going to be unable to help anybody else, and then we'll fall in bad ways, and then other people have to come help us. Okay, so taking care of ourselves is not something that's selfish. Okay, we're worthy of compassion, and it's also very practical. Yeah. Okay, then more reflections for your mealtime enjoyment. Follow the steps for cultivating love and compassion explained above. Make your contemplation personal. Now, we could have done this and written out each point in the series to make it easy for you. But if we did that, then you wouldn't have to go back and reread it and think about it yourself and make a list of each step in the series yourself. When you have to exert that effort, then you remember it. Then it affects your mind more. Okay. Then the second point is enjoy the expansive feeling in your heart as you release anger and judgment and allow unbiased affection to arise. Just imagine that for a minute. How nice it would feel to release anger and judgment. Somebody that you just are so judgmental of, you're able to release all that anger, all that judgment. Yeah. And see that, in a previous life, they were your mother, and in the present life, they've also been kind to you, and just see them through that lens. And wouldn't that be incredible? So, if you need to do it for a personal, somebody you know personally, or for a government official or whatever, just try and imagine like that and see how it affects you, how it changes your feelings and your perspective on life. Yeah. So you're the one, when we generate that kind of perspective, we're the ones who benefit, not the other person. I mean, they receive some benefit in the sense that hopefully we're nicer to them. But the real benefit accrues to us because we're changing our own mind and we're releasing these negative emotions and replacing them with positive ones. So a good state of mind. The calmer our mind, the easier it will be to deal with problems. Isn't that true? Yeah. Rather than wait for a crisis and then search for a way to handle it, we should practice open-mindedness and kindness on a daily basis. Then when problems or even traumatic events occur, their impact will be less severe and we'll be able to return to a balanced state of mind more quickly. On the other hand, if we indulge our bad moods, we'll feel overwhelmed when even small, unpleasant events occur. Isn't that true? Mm-hmm. Tibetans have a motto, hope for the best and prepare for the worst. Very practical, okay? It isn't just prepare for the worst. It's also hope for the best. And it isn't just hope for the best. It's also prepare for the worst, both of them. The main preparation is to let go of the self-centered attitude that magnifies our own problems and to cultivate compassion for ourselves and others. When difficulties arise, looking at them from a broad perspective is useful. Concentrating on my problems brings more frustration and unhappiness, while recollecting that everyone faces difficulties puts mine in perspective. In addition, if we see difficult circumstances as a challenge to rise to our potential and as an opportunity to call forth our compassion, we'll be more effective in managing a stressful situation and contributing something useful to it. In this way, our life will be worthwhile and our mind will be relaxed and open. In the next few sections, we will discuss some mental states and situations that people frequently see as troublesome: fear, depression, acceptance, comparing ourselves with others, and disagreements and conflict, and ways to train our mind to address them effectively.
I think these teachings provide a huge relief to the idea that we have fixed personalities that we can't change.
Yeah.
Because that's at least the way in which I was raised to believe, not in just a bad sense, but in a good sense of you have these good qualities that they're fixed. Mm. But the flip side of that is also you have these faults that are fixed and you fit into this type of person that then yeah. everyone else knows how to relate to you in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it can encourage you and you have this confidence about these good qualities, but also this sense of powerlessness that you're trapped by these faults that there's no way out of. So the idea that if you practice something, it becomes part of your temperament. It's like, wow, the world opens.
Yeah. Yeah, it really opens the door, doesn't it? And you see how, you know, we all like these little personality tests, you know, are we type A, are we type B, are we, you know, what kind of emotions do we feel this way and that? And we do tend to just say, okay, this is my personality. I was born like this and there's nothing I can do about it. And that attitude is so incorrect and self-defeating.
And two comments. First, when we were going over the part about neural pathways, creating new neural pathways, what came to mind is I don't know if I'd be able to do that without living in a monastery. I mean, it would be so difficult.
Mm.
I think that's the point. This whole environment is supportive of developing new
right.
ways of thinking.
Yeah.
So I see it as kind of indispensable for my own practice.
Yeah. And that's actually a good point, that we have to put ourselves in good situations. Yeah, if we really want to develop, because at the beginning we are so easily influenced by the environment, then it's really crucial that we put ourselves in good situations. Sometimes it's easy to be a little bit arrogant and think, oh, well, I can put myself in a difficult situation because I can manage it, you know. Or I'm going to, all these other people in this difficult situation are suffering, so I'm going to go there and save them, when we can't even manage our own mind first. Okay, so we really have to assess where we're at and what we're capable of accurately, and then make decisions in terms of what situation we put ourselves in, when we reach out to others, when we maybe don't do it ourselves but refer them to somebody else. Okay, so there's a lot of wisdom that needs to be developed here.
And then the reflection on releasing anger and judgment and allowing unbiased affection to arise, what came to mind is doing that towards myself. And if I could do that, how transformative it would be.
Yeah, wouldn't it?
And then I think I could get somewhere thinking about other people.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you have very heavy self-judgment, you got to start with yourself and start releasing that. Yeah. because it's all just garbage. All that self-judgment is just garbage. So we have to release it. Yeah? Otherwise, what are we going to do? Oh, I'm so creepy and grumpy, I can't do anything right. But other people are perfect and they can do everything. Is that an accurate view? That's not accurate.
Question. Mm-hmm. Could you please further explain what it means to indulge in our bad moods? Indulging seems to imply wanting it, whereas bad moods seem to overcome us.
Well, that's the thing. Bad moods seem to overcome us. But we have to check, do they really? Do they really overcome us? Or am I, for example, getting angry, but instead of applying an antidote to my anger and thinking about the situation in a different way, I instead ruminate on they did this to me and then they did that to me, in which case my bad mood gets worse. Okay? So we have, you know, we say, oh, our bad mood overwhelms us, as if we have no choice in the matter. And what I'm saying is, when we are able to really look at our mind closely, and this comes through doing your practice and watching how your mind works, then you can see that it isn't that the bad mood just comes and crashes on us and we're totally powerless. It isn't that at all. You know, there's something happens, our mind makes up a story, our habituated perspective steps in, we tell ourselves how awful it is. Okay? And in that way, we deepen the bad mood. Whereas if something happens that we don't like, if we can immediately go, okay, I didn't get what I want. Actually, that's quite good for me, not getting what I want. Yeah? I feel like I'm a princess and the whole world should revolve around me and I should get everything I want. And here, I didn't get what I want. And that's actually very good for me. It's good for my Dharma practice. So you think like that immediately, then no bad mood. Yeah? Then you don't have any bad mood. Whereas, if, you know, something happens and then you start, you know, they said this and then they must think that and then this other person saw that and they're going to think this and they're going to comment on somebody else too about that and then my whole reputation and this, that, and then this person will do that and that one will do this. And boy, you know, we're off and running. And we say the bad mood overwhelmed us, but we participated. Yeah, we participated. Okay. But we really have to slow down and be able to watch how these mental states develop in our mind. You know, and then we can see that, oh, there are ways to stop them there.
It's also interesting how if something bad happens to us, the reaction of those around us, mm-hmm. if they focus on it and, oh, it's terrible and da-da-da, you know, that helps to drag you down versus, these are the things that happen, and then you have more of a balanced perspective of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, yeah, things happen.
Yeah.
And so those around us, how they react to whatever befalls
yes.
us, is also interesting
yeah.
and can be powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. And that starts even when we're young. You know, have you noticed little kids? They fall down, then they immediately look at mom and dad. And depending on how mom and dad react, then they know whether they should cry or not. Sometimes they're generally hurt and they cry. But other times it's just, okay, you know, mom, dad, did I do something that is cry-worthy? And then they cry. Or do I do something that's not cry-worthy? Okay, I don't cry. Yeah, quite influenced by other people. That's why I like to joke about it, you know, when something happens and you saw, like last night, I said, okay, you know, I want some pity, you know, because if I joke about it, then it's just, it releases the whole thing. Yeah.
I've been noticing more and more lately how I feed my own anxiety. Mm. And it's like, I am so used to being in an anxiety mode that even if there is no reason for it, I find myself sort of revving myself up, like for the most minor thing.
Yeah.
And and sometimes it's, even though I notice it, it's kind of hard to stop sometimes because mm-hmm. that's where my mind wants to go or mm-hmm. likes to go or feels like it's the normal place to be at. And so some of the things that I am trying to figure out is how do I cut that? How do I not allow myself to go so much into it? And so, mm-hmm. yeah, it's interesting to see.
Yeah. And I think especially with anxiety, you're also going to have a biochemical reaction in your body and certain hormones or enzymes or whatever. And then you get used to how that feels in your body. And so then, like you say, even though everything's going along okay, I don't feel right even in my body because I'm not having that you know, biochemical response. So I better kind of rev up my anxiety mind to get that going. Yeah. And, you know, if you can begin to notice that and at that moment say, oh, no, I don't need to rev myself up. Yeah, I might get used to that feeling of whatever it is. I don't know the chemicals that are, you know, doing it. I might be used to that, but it's not actually a pleasant feeling. Yeah, it's really not actually a pleasant feeling. So I can change that pattern. I can change that habit.
I was reading years ago, I was reading about how sorrow or depression, you can get certain chemicals being released. Mm-hmm. And although we wouldn't consider them pleasant, you can become addicted to them. Mm-hmm. And so, and I see that as how we are so addicted to our own suffering.
Yeah.
Because it's familiar.
Yeah, it's very familiar. Yeah. I remember so clearly one of the people at DFF, when I was the teacher there, saying to me, because he suffered from depression, and he said, the one nice thing about depression is that you always know what tomorrow is going to be like. And that brings a sense of predictability and security. Yeah. Yeah. Yikes. Yeah, but this is somebody who had fought depression for a long time and said that. So, yeah, our suffering does become familiar. Yeah, and then when we try and overcome it, we feel lost. You know, who am I? Okay, so let's create new patterns and not realize, not worry about who we'll become if we let some of the old patterns go. That should not be an object of our worry. Yeah, there's some things we don't need to worry about, like, who am I going to be if I stop having so much anxiety? You know? Well, stop having the anxiety and find out. Yeah, it's part of my story. Who am I going to be? Well, let's find out.